This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a recent Supreme Court decision involving what's called qualified immunity for police officers.
There's a trend here. They're carving out a huge area. They might as well call it a license to kill.
We talk with a special group based in Brooklyn that helps bring justice to migrant workers across borders.
Amazing. These are the most vulnerable people in the world, and here they can get help, not only in the United States, but elsewhere.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. All too often, government officials, including law enforcement agencies, get away with gross abuses of power because they invoke the doctrine of qualified immunity. This is a doctrine that protects police who kill civilians. In the United States, 2,934 civilians were shot and killed by police since 2015. That is nearly 1,000 persons a year. In most European countries, the number of people killed by the police is zero. The doctrine of qualified immunity prevents government agents from being held personally responsible for constitutional violations unless the violation was of, quote, clearly established law. And this is something nearly impossible to prove. A Supreme Court decision a few weeks ago in the Casella v. Hughes case decided against the plaintiff victim of police abuse by a 7-2 majority. Two liberal justices, Sotomayor and Ginsburg, dissented. They opined that the majority of Supreme Court judges have established what they called an absolute shield, protecting police from what they labeled palpably unreasonable action that will go unpunished. We speak today with National Lawyers Guild Chicago attorneys Flint Taylor and Ben Elson of the renowned People's Law Office in Chicago. Their office has been dedicated to litigating civil rights, police violence, and government misconduct cases for 50 years. Taylor and Elson are the editors of the publication, The Police Misconduct and Civil Rights Law Reporter. Ben and Flint, welcome to Law and Disorder. And in your case, Flint, welcome back.
Well, it's great to be back.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Is the U.S. Supreme Court's recent ruling in Casella giving even more immunity to the police really a surprise?
I don't think it's a surprise. I think that the history of qualified immunity in the courts and the trends that we're seeing, how it's been broadened over the decades, the Supreme Court is clearly going in the direction of expanding the doctrine as much as it possibly can. So it's not a surprise. What's somewhat surprising to me is that the liberal wing of the court has basically been silent on this issue until very recently. Sotomayor filed a strong dissenting opinion in this most recent case, Casella, and was joined by Justice Ginsburg, but for the most part, the liberal justices have stayed out of the way, especially Justice Kagan. She didn't even join the dissent in this last opinion. So hopefully going forward they can be more assertive on this issue.
Chicago trade union leader Guy Miller has written, "Forget about serve and protect. That's a public relations hype. The police's ultimate function is to be a praetorian guard. They are the final defense of private property." We're talking here about banks, not toothbrushes. For the ruling elite, special privileges are granted to ensure their loyalty, like the doctrine of qualified immunity. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, that's not a new concept. Certainly it's something that's proven true through history ever since the police forces were created on the plantations down in the South and to fight against labor organizing in the North over the years and over the decades. And it turns out that whenever push comes to shove, even in the modern day scene, the police tend to do exactly what you're quoting from Mr. Miller as being their function. When in doubt, they definitely are protecting property. They are definitely protecting the interests of the ruling class and the property classes. And I should add, of course, with a tremendous amount of racism at the forefront of it all.
For further insurance, the ruling elite has taken prophylactic measures in anticipation of a crisis. We understand that several years ago they passed a law allowing the National Guard of one state to be ordered by the president to go into another state without the permission of the governor of either state. And the chief executive can also send in a mercenary for us, a private army, for example, like Eric Prince's outfit that was once called Blackwater. What are your thoughts on that?
It's another example of our government giving the police and law enforcement extraordinary powers to control the citizenry. And I think it ties in with this concept of qualified immunity. They bestow these special privileges on law enforcement that are really unnecessary and extremely problematic.
Well, when I started doing this work back when both Mike and I were young, in Chicago, there was quite a bit of cooperation and then exposure of how the military intelligence, the Chicago Police Department, and the FBI, as well as local kind of militia groups, right-wing groups, are all working together. And now we see it again with this Tiger Swan working very closely with the law enforcement forces at Standing Rock, and that the lawyers just uncovered some affidavits that show that they are unabashedly admitting they work together and were, and Tiger Swan, the Eric Prince operation, was and is working with local law enforcement to deal with the water protectors out there.
Could you please explain to our audience the origin of the doctrine of qualified immunity? I've read that the court simply made it up and that it has no real legal basis. What's the origin of it?
Yeah, that's right. The doctrine of qualified immunity says that a government official is immune from liability for violating an individual's constitutional rights unless the individual can show that the right in question was clearly established. And you're right, the Supreme Court made this up out of thin air, essentially. Immunity is not mentioned at all in the text of Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act or in the legislative history of the statute. It originated in a Supreme Court case called Pearson versus Ray, which was decided in 1967. And that was the first time that the court announced that law enforcement officials were entitled to qualified immunity from suits for damages. The court's rationale was that government officials should be protected from financial liability when they act in good faith in areas that are legally unclear. And since then, the doctrine has been expanded and strengthened by the Supreme Court considerably. In 1982, in a case called Harlow versus Fitzgerald, the Supreme Court held that qualified immunity protects government officials not only from financial liability, but also from the burdens of discovery and trial. And then in 1985, in a case called Mitchell versus Forsyth, the court ruled that since qualified immunity is an entitlement to not stand trial, when a court denies a defendant's pretrial motion to dismiss the case based on qualified immunity, the defendant can immediately appeal that order. And this is really significant because not only has the court provided government officials this really powerful defense against civil rights lawsuits, it's developed this procedure which makes it extremely difficult and time-consuming for civil rights plaintiffs to ever even get their case in front of a jury, because the defendants can almost always take a pretrial appeal, which oftentimes takes over a year to get resolved. So this is essentially the modern form of qualified immunity that we're forced to contend with today.
And if you look at the cases that Ben was talking about, there's a historical significance to all of them. It shouldn't be lost on you or people that Harlow was, of course, Bryce Harlow, who was a high official in the Nixon administration. And the companion case was Nixon versus Fitzgerald. And they gave absolute immunity in that context to Nixon as president and qualified immunity to Harlow. And Mitchell versus Forsyth was John Mitchell, of course, the major Justice Department henchman for Nixon during the Watergate era. And they were giving him the right to a pretrial appeal, which was pretty much unheard of for regular litigants, and still is to this day. So they kept carving out exceptions for government officials charged with corruption and violation of the Constitution, and as it has evolved each time, a little bit more of the ridiculous, intellectually bankrupt concept is extended so that we have today a qualified immunity concept which has swallowed the exception and has become this totally strong and unwieldy weapon, not only in the hands of the police and their lawyers, but in the hands of the reactionary appellate courts across the country.
Well, that dovetails nicely with our next question, which is about the recent trend in Supreme Court decisions on qualified immunity. Can you talk a little bit about some other cases? Is the Supreme Court raising the bar on this?
Yeah, the Supreme Court has been very aggressive on this issue. It clearly has an agenda to curb civil rights lawsuits against police officers. It's issued 20 opinions on qualified immunity since 2001, and in 18 of those opinions, it found that the government officials were entitled to qualified immunity because the plaintiff couldn't produce a precedent with facts that were similar enough to those of the case at bar. So the clear trend that we're seeing now is a broadening of the scope of the doctrine. And in many of these recent Supreme Court opinions, the court has summarily reversed the lower court's denial of qualified immunity, which is really unusual. It's supposed to be very rare for the Supreme Court to issue a summary reversal, but they've been doing it over and over again in these qualified immunity cases. And in their decisions, they make it very clear, they reprimand the lower courts for applying qualified immunity in a manner that's too favorable to the plaintiffs. So they're really going out of their way to send a message to the lower courts that they must be extremely deferential to law enforcement, especially when it comes to police officers' use of deadly force, which is the fact pattern that we see in these police shooting cases that they've been deciding recently.
And I think that it's really important to put this in a historical and a current context, because you see the rise of the movement for Black Lives and other movements of young folks who are raising these issues in the streets and also in the courts, and you see on video now what we lawyers who have been doing these shooting cases for decades have always seen, which is that they are shooting people down with little or no reason, particularly people of color. Now we have videos that prove it, but when you get past the public outrage of it all, what do you have? You have prosecutors who, by and large, don't want to bring the cases. You have juries and judges who, by and large, don't want to, particularly in the criminal context, want to find a police officer guilty of a serious criminal offense, such as murder or attempted murder or even manslaughter. You have a Justice Department which now has been taken over by Trump, and the modest gains that were made under Obama and Holder with regard to dealing with patterns and practices of police brutality and abuse are being rolled back, not only in Chicago, but in other urban and settings. And then basically you have what we used to call and what the courts used to call private attorney generals, and that's us. That's the private lawyers who bring cases on civil cases under the Civil Rights Act on behalf of people who are shot, brutalized, the families of people who are murdered by the police. And so what happens in that field? Instead of it being broadened so that there can at least be some judicial remedy for this kind of outrageous misconduct, the opposite happens. You have qualified immunity. You have limitations on suing the government agency. So instead of being able to attack their patterns and practices of shooting first and asking questions later, particularly in contexts where mentally disturbed people are involved, which happens so many times now, the courts say, that's all right, there's no civil remedy. So you have no criminal remedy, you have no pattern and practice remedy, and you have no civil remedy or criminal remedy. So I guess the only answer is the streets. And fortunately, we have people in the streets raising these issues.
I have a related question that involves off-duty officers working on private detail. And I know that different jurisdictions have different rules about this. In New York, I see police officers wearing their uniform, but standing, for example, in a bookstore on private contract. The Ninth Circuit in 2017 ruled that off-duty officers on private guard duty are not covered by qualified immunity. Is this the state of the law across the country, to your knowledge?
Well, whenever you hear the Ninth Circuit, that's a circuit that Trump and the Supreme Court thinks is out of step with the conservative attitudes about policing. So the Ninth Circuit is one of the best circuits in the federal court system. So I wouldn't necessarily say that, unless there's a Supreme Court decision on that particular issue, I wouldn't say that would be the general law across the nation with regard to that. But there has to be a dealing with these private police forces. Unfortunately, even if they're not afforded immunity, then you have another question. Were they acting under color of law? And if they were not acting under color of law, then you can't use the Civil Rights Act to sue them. So it could get you in a catch-22 situation, even if they don't have immunity.
The People's Law Office has been litigating these cases for 5 decades or so, and I wanted to ask you, I don't think you've ever lost a case where the defense has been qualified immunity. But I wanted to ask you if you could tell us about a case or two in particular and what the facts were and how this comes up and how you beat it back.
Well, right now we have an appeal pending in the Seventh Circuit that involves qualified immunity. We represent the family of a young black man named Derek Williams who died in the custody of Milwaukee police officers in 2011. He was arrested by the police after leading them on a foot chase, and after they took him into custody, he immediately started to complain that he couldn't breathe and showed physical signs of being in some type of medical distress. And the police ignored his complaints because they claimed they thought he was faking it. So they dragged him to the squad car, they threw him inside, and over the next 15 minutes, he slowly suffocated to death in the back seat of the car. And one of the unique aspects about this case is that there's this horrific videotape of the last minutes of Derek's life because the squad car was equipped with a video camera that recorded him while he was dying in the back seat. And you can see and hear him telling the police officer who was sitting in the front seat the entire time that he can't breathe, he can't breathe. And the police officer doesn't do anything to help him, and then he dies. So this case was set to go to trial last August when the city of Milwaukee took an interlocutory appeal based on qualified immunity. And they're essentially arguing that the case should be dismissed because we can't point to a prior case with similar facts that put the officers on notice that their conduct was unconstitutional. We're optimistic that we're going to win the appeal, but it's a good example of the problems, the serious, serious problems presented by qualified immunity, because in this case, it gave the defendants the ability to delay our clients from having their day in court for at least an extra year while we litigate this appeal. Not to mention the fact that it's given them the chance to have our case dismissed prior to trial, which would really be an outrageous result.
Ben and Flint, as you know, several of these recent Supreme Court cases have involved police shootings. Is it more than a coincidence that the Supreme Court has been issuing these decisions in the midst of the recent high-profile police killings of African-American men and the Black Lives Matter movement?
unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think it's a coincidence at all. If you look at the facts of the two most recent cases that I mentioned, the California case, the Sheehan case, and also the most recent case, the Hughes case, in both of those situations, fortunately, the women victims survived, but in both of those situations, they were having mental episodes of one type or another. In the Sheehan case, the police came to answer a complaint at a mental facility. The woman had a knife, and she was acting in what the police construed as a threatening manner. The San Francisco police had a unit they could have called that could have de-escalated and dealt with it as a medical issue rather than as a threat that required deadly force. They chose not to, but they rather rushed her and shot her. In the other case, the Hughes case, similarly, the woman who was shot by the police appeared to be threatening another woman with a knife. It turned out that that woman was her roommate, and the woman didn't feel threatened, but the police shot her rather than to try to de-escalate the situation. In both of those cases, the courts gave a carte blanche under qualified immunity for the police to act as they did, said it was reasonable. And in our own office, we have a couple of cases similar to that, and I think that you're seeing these kinds of cases, particularly with the fact that mental health treatment is being cut back and has been cut back both in this city and across the country for decades, that people who aren't getting the treatment they should are on the streets and maybe acting in a manner that the police can construe in such a way that allows them under these principles to use deadly force. And then you have the video showing the unreasonableness of it all. Then you see the outrage that goes across the city or the county or the state where it happened. But these police officers and these municipalities are being given that carte blanche, and the police officers, rather than to be restrained, are being encouraged by the qualified immunity defenses to do the shooting and to, as Justice Sotomayor said in her dissent, to shoot first and ask questions later.
Ben Elson, Flint Taylor, the two of you are partners in the renowned Chicago law firm, the People's Law Office. Can you just talk a bit about your law office, what you're trying to do, and how people can get a hold of you?
People can get a hold of us in Chicago, peopleslawoffice.com, or the phone number is 773-235-0070. And we try to live up to our name, the People's Law Office. It was given to us by the Black Panther Party back in the late 60s when we founded our office, and we founded it on the fighting the case of the murder, assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the Black Panther leaders who were shot down in their bed here in Chicago in 1969. We've continued to fight those kind of cases over the decades, and such cases as the John Birch police torture cases that are so notorious in this city and have been for over three decades. And we've, of course, talked about those cases several times, Mike and Heidi, in the past, and they continue. Did a hearing in a torture case where a man's been held for over 35 years based on a tortured confession. So those cases continue, and so many others, and that Ben and I and all of the other lawyers, there's about nine lawyers in our office, and we continue to do those kinds of cases.
I understand that you have a memoir coming out called The Torture Machine by Flint Taylor. We'll have you on when it gets off the press. And in the meantime, Heidi and I would both like to thank you very much for the good work that you guys do and for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
It's always good to be with you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Attorneys who represent migrant workers faced a host of challenges in transnational employment litigation. Some of these challenges range from not being able to obtain a visa for clients poised to begin trial, but are physically back at home in Guatemala or another country, and can't return to testify. Or clients may be entitled to past wages, but their U.S. lawyers are unable to locate them once they've left the states. For some lawyers, for whom it's cost prohibitive to keep in contact or track down clients when the case goes to trial, they forego representing them entirely. This is where the organization Justice in Motion comes in. Their unique cross-border model helps advocates and migrants overcome these barriers to what they call portable justice. Their mission is to ensure that migrants who suffered exploitation abroad are able to access justice even if they've returned to their home countries. They connect advocates and defenders and support the development of cases to ensure that transnational litigation is working effectively and smoothly on behalf of migrant workers. The organization plays a pivotal role in persuading attorneys to work on cases with a transnational dimension and to not forego them because of legal or logistical obstacles. This has led to a significant increase in the number of advocates in the region providing transnational legal services to migrants. We are joined today by longtime National Lawyers Guild member Kathleen Caron. Kathleen is the founding executive director of Justice in Motion, and she's also one of our lawyers you'll like. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Kathleen.
Thank you, Heidi.
Our listeners may not be aware of migrants from places like Mexico and Central America who are struggling to access the U.S. justice system. Can you tell us a bit about their cases? Are they employment-related, and how big a problem is this?
Sure. It really started around employment issues, looking at that businesses are global, workers are global, but justice is not. That was the core around why I founded the organization in 2005. So the issue of accessing justice is if you physically go home to your country of origin after suffering a labor abuse, which could be wage theft to employment discrimination to human trafficking, the whole spectrum of exploitation, but you go home, whether by force or choice, back to the country of origin, your rights do not stop at the border, but most people think they do, or for practical reasons they do, or for legal challenges they do. So we're here to make sure that justice crosses borders.
So as an example, an individual may bring a case, say they weren't paid their wages for months. They begin the case, they have representation, and then for some reason they have to return home, family member sick, whatever. How big an issue is this? Are we talking thousands of cases in the U.S.?
Well, if you look at the temporary foreign guest worker program, so there's non-immigrant visas that permit work. So if you look at H-2A, which is agriculture, H-2B, which is non-agriculture, less than a year, landscapers, construction, seafood workers, they by definition return to the country of origin within 12 months. So a lot of our cases, I would say probably more than half of our cases are guest workers. There's other types of non-immigrant visa categories, about 11, that we work on specifically for low-wage workers that cross borders and face exploitation. Of course, you also have undocumented workers that go back for a variety of reasons, family reasons. Now, of course, deportations are on the rise, which is one of the reasons why we expanded our work beyond labor.
Now, we want to talk about your defender network, but before that, I'm curious, if a judge is presiding over one of these cases, don't the lawyers mention the possibility that their client may have to return home or may not be there for the duration? Is that, it's got to be something they're all aware of.
Well, it really depends on the circumstances. So if you look at employers for temporary foreign guest worker programs, it is obviously foreseeable that the worker is going to go back because the visa ends. But what happens is the employers want their cake and eat it too, right? So we're actually producing a law review article on this exact topic, because as soon as they go back to the country of origin, they say, oh, it's a hardship. How can we possibly depose them overseas? It's unfair to us. They have to come back to the jurisdiction. So they're just set up to fail. The temporary guest worker program, which I could talk about for a very long time, sets workers up to fail. And there's no system to allow for portable justice, is what we call it, ensuring that migrants have access to justice across borders. With undocumented workers, it really depends, because a lot of people stay in the country, right, in the United States. And so if your client goes back for whatever reason, it's just strategy about kind of how much can you do before the worker goes back. You maybe you never need to reveal it. Maybe it's not relevant to the case. But often if you're doing a class action or representative action, or there's just more people that are affected, they could be back in the countries of origin, and then you want to bring them into the claim as well. So it's really case specific of kind of when it gets brought up.
So I mentioned your defender network. I understand you train and support human rights advocates in other countries. Can you talk about what they do and how that fits into your overall mission?
Sure. It's really the core of our work. So the Defender Network is what makes our work unique and why it has the impact it does. So we are now working in Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. So 5 countries. Which we are the countries of origin of source countries for migrants going to the U.S. and Canada. We do a little bit of work in Canada, but it's dominated by our U.S. work. So these are what we realize is that to really talk about transnational migration, you have to have a transnational strategy and you have to be working with advocates across borders. You can't come up with unilateral solutions, meaning U.S. lawyers, U.S. paralegals trying to deal with clients in the country of origin all on their own, because it's not systemic and you're not really bringing advocates in the countries of origin to the table to talk about the issues that are affecting their migrants. So the whole idea was to leverage local resources, right? There's already really good organizations, we all know it, in the countries of origin. They just don't know about U.S. labor rights. They don't know about U.S. immigration rights or U.S. civil rights. And they don't know how to counsel clients who walk in their door. So perhaps a local human rights organization is very used to, dealing with the local community because they're community members themselves of resolving issues. But when it is about something that happens to a community member in another country, it's very difficult for them to know how to address it, right? So why would they know how to address it? So that's where we come in. So we built the network slowly but surely, walking into people's offices saying this is the issue, you have migrants in the United States, this is how it gets affected. U.S. lawyers are hampered to really help them. They try their best, but often because of resource triage, workers get dropped from these cases. Because it's like, look, I have 100 clients in my office in Manhattan and 2 in Honduras. Well, forget it. The ones in Honduras are obviously going to get cut off. But why punish migrants for being migrants, right? The justice system needs to adjust to the reality of migrants, not that migrants just get cut off because they go home and have other responsibilities. So it's really, we're up to about 42 human rights organizations and individual attorneys who want to collaborate in this network. So then we train them on the U.S. legal rights. And we also do some work in the country of origin under country of origin laws as well. But we had our first big gathering in November where we brought them all together. We'd never been able to do that before, to kind of create more of a shared vision of the network for the next decade of the work.
So, Kathleen, tell us a success story or two.
Mm-hmm, sure. Oh, there's lots. So we intervene in a small part, right? So we are not litigating directly ourselves, right? So we are not filing cases in the United States. So we'll get a call. So, for example, restaurant worker in Texas, undocumented worker washing dishes, goes home for whatever reason to the country of origin, and they can't find, there's a law clinic doing the case in Texas, and they can't find the client anymore. But they're all geared up to do this suit. So instead of giving up the case, they call us to say, can you track down this client? Because we are in the process and we're going to recover overtime wages, but we've lost contact with this client. So they call us, we screen the case. Is this a viable case? Are we interested in it? And then is there a defender who is interested in taking the case, right? Because the defenders don't have to. They're not our employees. They're not obligated to do it. This is all kind of collaboration. And so if they're willing to do it, and we do have a low-cost kind of reimbursement for the defenders, it's not pro bono. That model wouldn't work. But it's modest enough so the U.S. organizations can pay for it, for their time and direct costs, right? Like, we just pass it through. So they will go out and find that worker and sign up that worker. So that worker who had kind of forgotten about this case back in Texas now got his wages back, right? So he got thousands of dollars back that he never would have gotten because the U.S. lawyers had no idea where it was. So that's a small case, right? Other times we're working on much bigger cases, right? Like class action types of cases for wage theft, and maybe there's people that are involved that should have rights to claim, right, in the settlement or the award, but they have no idea about it. So then our defenders would go out and find those workers and say, you're entitled to $3,000. Like, what? You worked in planting pine trees on an H-2B visa in Virginia, 5 years ago, and you actually, those lawyers that you may or may not remember even meeting right, have won that lawsuit, and so we're going to sign you up. And so what we do is just maximize the impact. And really, it's a cost saving for the U.S. lawyers because they are saving a lot of money, not spinning their wheels and recreating the wheel again and again when they have some random case in some random country, because they're going to learn if they have enough resources to work in the country of origin and send people down there, it's probably a one-off, right? They're never going to probably have to go back to that country again and do it again. But when you're working with the Defender Network, you're building up the local capacity and their understanding of the issues affecting their migrants. And it's just a beautiful thing on both sides, right? For the U.S. lawyer, often they've never worked across borders with a human rights attorney in the country of origin. And, you know, our defenders are getting much more experience with every case. So those are two labor examples. You know, we've done sexual exploitation on the workplace as well. And we have new initiatives around immigration and civil rights as well.
I was going to ask, because recently we did interview some guests about the issue of sexual exploitation of farm workers. Does that represent a significant number of your cases or no?
No, I think we've only done, that was a restaurant case. I don't know if we've worked on, we've done a pregnancy discrimination case in Canada. We did sexual exploitation in a restaurant in New York. I don't know if we've had a specific, and probably legal directors listening to this thinking, yes, we did. But, you know, that I recall off the top of my head, we haven't done a specific to, you know, gender exploitation or sexual exploitation in the fields.
I want to hear more about successes. Tell me another story.
Do you want to hear about some immigration cases? Or you want me to stick to the worker rights cases?
Immigration.
Also, sure.
Oh, okay. So we expanded to immigration because of the children. The unaccompanied minors coming up from Central America really – we started getting a lot of phone calls for help, right, to address with issues, which I'll explain now. So we have been doing immigration ancillary to the labor cases. So if it had risen to the exploitation of human trafficking, there might be a T visa, which allows the person who suffered the exploitation, the survivor, to remain in the United States safely. So then they're allowed to bring up their children. And there was a lot of problems with the birth certificates in the country of origin, just paperwork in the country of origin. So we're like, oh, sure, we can help with that. Because these offenders have huge amount of experience in a variety of different areas, right? So some are family law lawyers. Some are, I mean, there are lots of, you name it, one of our defenders probably does it because it's so varied. So correcting birth certificates wasn't that hard. So we kind of did it that way at the beginning, right? Just doing little bits of work. But the unaccompanied minors was a game changer for us. So we started getting a lot of calls because the first step to acquire SIJ, right, special immigrant juvenile status, is to establish guardianship in the United States. To establish guardianship in the United States in a family court action, you need to terminate the parental rights. So the non-custodial parent, because you need to prove abandonment, abuse, and neglect, right? Kind of your parents can't take care of you. You need to become custody in the United States. And then you can move on to DHS and get the status, immigration status. But you have a family law judge determine that first step. So this meant that immigration lawyers had to find the parent, the non-custodial parent, the country of origin, and serve process that there was a court hearing in the United States advancing and your parental rights were at stake and you had the right to appear, which was a good, very important right. But imagine these family law lawyers saying, I have no idea to find an incarcerated dad. So that was one of our examples. We get a call and they said, this guy's in jail for murder, for, you know, gang-related murder. Like, what? How are we going to deal with this situation, right? So they contacted us for help. The human rights defender said, there's no way I can go into the prison system and talk to this guy, even if it's for something as simple as, you know, explaining his rights under this procedure that's happening in the United States, because I will then be affiliated with him and then I'm a target. Way too dangerous. So what he did was, she did an affidavit explaining that situation, why service of process was impossible. The judge was convinced the child was protected in the United States and the case moved on. So this just started happening and happening, and it reached 50% of our workload. So that's when we stopped and reflected and said, okay, are we really about cross-border labor rights? Are we really about justice across borders for migrants? And we said the latter, right? So we actually changed our name. We were founded as Global Workers Justice Alliance, you know, labor being the core of the work, but then changed our name just about a year and a half ago to Justice in Motion to encompass that immigration work.
What a wonderful model you have. I'm curious if other organizations have approached you about starting similar type networks, or is replication something you're interested in helping others to do?
Definitely. I mean, there's such great organizations all around the world that just aren't connected to be able to help the migrants access justice across borders. I did go to Europe once. It was really fun. I went to Turkey, and I was asked to speak to PICUM, which is the Platform for Cooperation on International Migration, to talk about this when the return directive came down, the EU return directive, and they were expecting a lot of undocumented workers to be expelled from the European Union about, you know, several years ago. So I came in and talked about the model and what were the assumptions that I had in place to be able to make it work. Right, because depending where, you know, the rule of law and the country of origin, whether there's actually actors that can do this, there's kind of some criteria that I realized that were inherent to be able to launch it with the U.S. as the receiving country.
Can you talk about some of the frustrating aspects of your work at this point? You're pretty well established now. You built this from the ground up. And it sounds as though things are going smoothly, but what impediments do you currently face, or what would make your job easier?
Countries really think are bounded by their own borders, the way they approach justice, even when you look at funding, right, how foundations kind of think and organize their programs. So that's been really hard, right? So on every level, whether you're looking at our policy work, our legal work, or migrant education, just to say, you know, migrants cross borders, therefore, we have to think of that. You always have to think of multiple countries at the same time. You have to think of multiple jurisdictions when you're changing laws. You have to think about what happens in the countries of origin. So that's really frustrating. I mean, I think if you look at the non-immigrant visas, the guest worker program, some people call them temporary foreign worker programs, which is the more global term for them, they're designed thinking about that workers never leave, right? There's no, they don't work into the system. And I hope it's not intentional, but, you know, who knows? That just once they go home, it gets cut off. So I think that constant frustration of the national mindset frustrates our work in lots of ways. And I think the people that engage in it, it's very liberating, the defenders and the U.S. advocates. It's really fun because, you know, they are truly working in a transnational fashion to do something that you can't do alone. Like our work inherently, you cannot do it by yourself. You have to have a partner on the other side of the border.
Now, Kathleen, the three of us in this studio are all members of the National Lawyers Guild. That's how we met you originally.
Right.
Tell us how you got interested in this kind of work.
I think it started, well, I out of law school, I went to American University in D.C., and my first job was a NAPL fellowship, which is now the EJW fellowship, in Florida. So I was representing migrant farm workers in employment law cases in the fields of Florida. So they were all undocumented workers. And I had previously to that, before law school, lived in Guatemala for almost 4 years doing different human rights work. So I'd seen firsthand, you know, how the talent and the dedication and the sacrifices and risks that human rights defenders in Guatemala take. So when I started doing this work, we had clients that went back to the country of origin. At that time, there weren't any deportations going on, or very few. So it was really more by choice or accidents and not accessing quickly enough the workers' compensation system, right? One case in particular stood out. There was a woman who was pregnant, and just a couple weeks before her deposition, she said, "My husband's mother is dying, and we're returning to Guatemala because we need to be with her before she dies." And I was saying, like, but you're owed $3,000. You just, you could, you know, like, stay here for the deposition, get your money, have your baby, whatever. So, but she went because family is more important, right? Like, migrant values are not, are family values, they're human values.
Right.
They're not weighing these things that, you know, the devious right sometimes think. It's all so calculated. It's just not. It's all motivated by, it's really motivated by family.
Right.
So many decisions that are made by all of us, including migrants. So she went back to the country of origin, and I had to drop her from the case. So I thought, this is crazy, because what if I was just working with someone in the country of origin, perhaps I could have pulled this together and figured it out. But in that time frame, it was just simply too short. So that was kind of one of the first motivations to do it, is how can we do this better? I really see kind of how the U.S. farm worker movement was really trying to do work in the countries of origin on necessity, but how difficult it was, how inefficient it was, how the impact was really limited without kind of having counterparts helping with the work. So that was where the idea of portable justice really started. And then I went to East Timor, and that's really where it cemented, when I saw my eyes were much bigger than the U.S., kind of U.S.-Mexico Central America corridor, that it really was any country where you're having people cross borders, so I was working on a human trafficking project over there, it was relevant too. So I came back to the region really determined to work on the issue.
We're speaking with attorney Kathleen Curran, who is the executive director of Justice in Motion. And I wanted to ask you, Kathleen, over the last several years, I know that the situation when Obama was the president was terrible in terms of deportations. And I wanted to know, is there some kind of trend that's making it even worse now with Trump? And what have you noticed in your job?
Oh, yes. Definitely a lot of increases in violations, but people don't want to speak up at the same time. So then it's hard to measure it. I think for us in the immediate term, we launched a civil rights project, which is new for us. You know, we hadn't worked on that issue at all. A couple cases here and there. But that's been a new and exciting project for us. So during arrest, detention, and removal of migrants, a lot of people are having their rights violated, right? So there could be a civil rights claim. So we started launching the project last year in response to the Trump regime. And it's pretty exciting. So we did it. We actually started pretty early. So migrants weren't yet being deported. But actually that was interesting for us because usually the case is well underway when we get contacted, right? It's maybe the end of the case or, you know, some of the first clients in the first depositions, but we're never in the strategy stage, right? The U.S. lawyers are working up the strategy. They call us in when they need the cross-border piece. This gave us the opportunity to be in early with some civil rights lawyers who could foresee that they could have some clients deported at some point, and then what were they going to do? How viable was their case, again, when they had to do it across border? So this was really exciting. So we did this gathering in Guatemala at the beginning of March with some civil rights lawyers and organizations, 10 of our defenders from the Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, to plan out some of the cases and how we'd specifically work on them. So that's one response that we've done. So we're kind of ready. So if anyone out there listening has a civil rights case coming along and they think they're going to have deported clients to the Northern Triangle, like, we really want to support and work on those cases. And the immigration cases have spiked for sure, because if anyone has a shot of getting their papers, they're trying for it. So the demands on our immigration program has hugely increased.
You know, we usually ask this question towards the end, but since you brought it up, if there's somebody out there listening and needs your help, how do people reach you?
Sure. So our website is justiceinmotion.org. And then you can just, you know, write to me, Kathleen at justiceinmotion.org or info at justiceinmotion.org, or just call our number 646-351-1160 and we will start it all up.
Kathleen, we do just have a few minutes remaining, but I wanted to ask you, if you had a role model in particular in the Guild who inspired you through this process, or just generally in starting your own organization?
Yeah, no, the Guild has definitely been instrumental, right? When I did my work in Florida, that I was active in the Southeast Regional.
Right,
that was our,
right.
And that was just having colleagues out there doing similar work. When I was, you know, in Belgrade, Florida, in a farm worker town, I didn't have a lot of kind of lefty colleagues around to connect with. I mean, coming to New York was very interesting. We're based out of Brooklyn. New York is just so big. There's just so much of everything. Whereas when you live in different parts of the United States, you're really reaching out to find people that do something similar, a supportive network. But in New York, it's like there's so many. It's almost in a bizarre way. You get even more lost because there's just too many people here. So the Guild has always been important. I was when I was a student, I was at NGL, a student vice president for a year, right? And so that's probably how I met you,
yes.
Heidi. And so I've been, I definitely was very active at the beginning of my career and continue to be involved, not as much as I probably should be, but this does take a lot of my time.
Of course. Now I want to ask, what advice might you have for young, recently admitted attorneys or law students who love the kind of work you're doing, have their own ideas, but are discouraged by, you know, fundraising or not making enough money to survive? What motivated you through this initial process, especially those early years?
Right. I think founding an organization is really challenging. So I think you have to care about it so much, the issue, that you can't sleep, right? So, and if you're not at that level, it probably is not worth it. And then if you think, if you have an idea of how to address it uniquely, look to where you need to do your homework and make sure no one else is doing it. If someone's doing something similar, try to join them if that's possible, right? Or try to be housed in another organization. So I definitely tried all those routes, but people weren't working on this issue and we just didn't fit. Like I just said before, what were the challenges? You know, we don't fit anywhere. We're not direct services. We're not representing clients. You know, we're not just doing advocacy because we have this semi-direct service. So it was hard for us to fit. So I'd say for young people starting out, don't replicate something. Don't just, if you just want to lead because you want to lead, that's starting wrong, right? Like I think you really, it has to be an issue that you feel is not addressed. Vet the issue, get feedback on the issue. And only then if people are saying, your model sounds great, it sounds really needed, it is needed, and then you need people to help you get started. And then you're going to have to get consultancy gigs and things like that to pay the bills. It's definitely, you know, this is not the way to, you know, be financially well off is founding an organization, unless you're very famous out of the box, and then that's different. But if you're not known, it's definitely a struggle. Another bit of advice for people out of law school is to, I mean, I live in New York City and I know people want to be in New York City, but I always say get out of the city because there's so many good opportunities in underserved areas in the United States. And then you can get really good jobs. You can get lots of responsibility. And then if you really want to be in city, you're much more of an attractive candidate. There's so much competition in New York. So I always say, you know, I was out. I never planned to live in New York, but, you know, I worked in South Dakota and Alabama and in Florida. And there's just so much to do out there that I just encourage people to get out of their comfort zone and go out there and make a big difference.
You know, I used to give the same advice to people. If you want to get involved politically, it's a lot easier to do it outside of New York, where you can really be a factor in the city in which you're living. Justice in Motion, talk to us some more about how people can get a hold of you before we have to say goodbye.
Sure. So the website is www.justiceinmotion.org, and or just give us a call or shoot us an email at info@justiceinmotion.org. And we'd love to talk to you about anything cross-border.
Kathleen, Karen, what a great organization you founded and really brought to, I won't say maturity, but perhaps adolescence and poised for some even more great things.
Oh, thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. You take it easy.
Bye-bye. Right,
thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.